Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the Tennis and Bagels podcast. And today we're going to be talking about the Australian Open. And this is a recap episode. And there's a lot to talk about. We have a new major champion in Jannik Sinner and a lot of other storylines, narratives, and interesting things to talk about. And no better guest to do it than the wonderful Hall of Famer and expert analyst, Steve Flink. And you guys always love these chats. So, Steve, this is it's great to do this again with you at the start of the new year.
Bunch, it's a pleasure to be back with you. And I thought this one actually, from start to finish, I guess we had 35 five-setters on the men to tie a record. U.S. Open 83 was the other. That was sort of symbolic of what a great tournament this was and how many memorable clashes we had. So I know you and I will have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, for sure. And it was a tournament that really delivered in terms of storylines at the very top of the men's game, with all the quarterfinalists being, you know, seven of the top eight to ten best players in the world. And it really sort of delivered on all fronts. Of course, Jannik Sinner continuing his fantastic form since Wimbledon of last year and really kind of cementing himself as someone who's going to win many more majors, I think. Would you share that view?
Oh, completely. Completely. I think we're heading toward what I like the most about this is I know that I'm convinced that Djokovic will be examining his rival with Sinner very carefully and trying to figure out what he needs to do in the short term. And they will have, over the next couple of years, some dandies. And obviously, and then at some point, you know, Novak is going to turn 37 in May. And, you know, I certainly see him playing on through next year and maybe 1 year after that. But then when looking at the next decade and beyond, obviously we can eagerly anticipate so many incredible battles between Sinner and Carlos Alcaraz. So he set the stage for it now because he was a little behind the curve. Although he's a couple of years older than Carlos, Carlos was the one who got on the board first at the majors and won the U.S. Open 2 years ago and won Wimbledon last year. And so this was, I think Sinner's supporters would say this is overdue. So now he's arrived. And I think, it's going to be very interesting for me to observe what these three guys, along with Medvedev, it's just an astonishing top four right now.
Yeah, for sure. They've certainly separated themselves from the rest of the field. And if we look at Sinner's run all across the board, I guess what impressed me the most is just obviously how well he took care of business in the early rounds, because that's always something that for him, you know, we've seen him embroiled in all these five-set encounters. And this time we really saw him kind of head and shoulders, you know, beat the players he's supposed to beat in straight sets. And it wasn't an easy draw by any means. I mean, to get through Khachanov and then get through Rublev and then obviously the four-setter against Djokovic, who was off, should be said. Of course, the first two sets he himself said was some of the worst sets of tennis he's ever played in majors. And then of course, the final against Medvedev, where he really, took care of Daniil after going down two sets to love and stayed so calm and composed and found a way out of it while Medvedev was also feeling it physically, having spent over 24 hours on court. So I look at this as a really positive event for both Daniil and Jannik, and I kind of don't think of this match for Medvedev like the one against Rafa 2 years ago. I think they're completely different situations here.
They are. Listen, he can be excused more easily. It's strange for us to be thinking and saying that this one is more justifiable than the loss to Rafa. But the difference then was that he had a relatively straightforward march through the tournament. He saved a match point in a five-setter against FAA. But otherwise, you know, it wasn't that taxing. He was fresh physically. Rafa's barely played the second half of 2021. So it made Medvedev a pretty big favorite. And then to get Rafa down two sets and Rafa having to play 5 hours to beat him, that was crushing because he was almost up a break in the third. He was 3-2, love 40. And that set got away. And then Rafa really dug in, got his teeth into the contest, eventually beat Daniel 7-5 in the fifth. He's admitted now, he's admitted more recently that that essentially ruined the rest of his campaign that year. He couldn't get over that one. I agree. This one, psychologically, he can deal with it better. And you knew already how to work. You're so right to point out to the fact that Sinner was extremely efficient. It's very hard, Vance, to be losing sets if you lose your serve twice in six matches on your way to the final. Somebody's going to have to squeeze you out in a tiebreak. And that, of course, where he could have been in trouble had he lost the second set to Rublev. And it was 5-1 down in the tiebreak. That could have gotten interesting had Rublev managed to finish off that tiebreak. But that was the only really precarious moment for Sinner along the way. Now, just to return to Daniel a bit, to Medvedev, I'm essentially in accord with you. I don't think he goes away in dismayed or discouraged by what happened, because he knew he had really had to earn his place in that final. He'd done it. He'd made two comebacks and two sets to let down, including the semifinal against Zverev. He had 3-5 setters altogether when you add the Hurkacz match in. Only one straight set match. And yet here he was in the first two sets of the final playing, I think, two of the best sets I've ever seen from him, especially given the level of aggression. Missing so little, hitting so hard, forehand up 6 miles an hour on average. There were so many good signs, and it might have looked desperate at first. People might have looked at him and said, "What's he doing? That's not how he plays." But he sustained that level really, essentially, even through the third set. I think, you know, because it wasn't until the end of the third that he got broken at 4-5, and not for the first time. That was only the second time he was broken, but the first time it was up two breaks in the second set at 5-1, which, by the way, I think hurt him. I think it hurt him significantly that he didn't close that set out sooner for a variety of reasons, but we can get to that. Bottom line is, my only question is, will Medvedev continue to, obviously we saw him moving in on the baseline return serve a lot, not point in, point out, but he started to do it against Hurkacz. He did it at times against Zverev. He did it again in the final. The idea of shifting his position, I think, is great. He needs to be more flexible. He proved to himself that he can do it. If he moves in, he can make the returns. He didn't seem to think so prior to that, but I think he learned something. And then the aggressive, harder hitting style from the baseline, which is designed to have shorter points, and it works so beautifully because he caught Sinner completely off guard. Sinner was astonished at what was coming at him, and he started making errors that he had not made the whole tournament, but understandably so. So I just think, obviously, if Medvedev had come away with a win, if he managed to squeeze it out and finish it off in three or maybe in four, where he had a shot in the 4-2, 3-all break point, he would have left there feeling just on top of the world. As it is, he's still feeling pretty good. He's been in the last two major finals. The issue is going to be what happens if he has to play an Alcaraz, a Sinner, or Djokovic, any of the other three guys that share the top four level with him in the next couple of finals that he might play. Is he capable of beating them? Yes, he is, but he's still going to be hard-pressed to do it. Because you're looking at Djokovic as a 24-time major champion. Carlos has already taken the two biggest titles in the sport, one each the last few years. Now Sinner's on the board. And Sinner has beaten a Medvedev now four times in a row. So he has all of that to think about too, but it's very interesting. If I'm Medvedev, I'm certainly feeling a lot better about myself now than I was at the end of the U.S. Open when Novak beat him in straight sets in the final.
Yeah, that's a really good assessment. My other question would also be, you know, the aggressive versions of Medvedev that we saw, for instance, you know, the taking the return super early, cutting off second serve returns, coming forward and volleying really well behind the aggressive.
Yeah.
And the sort of tennis that we saw him play when he came back from two sets to love down against Zverev in the third and fourth set. where he managed to be the more aggressive of the two in the big moments, and also the first two sets against Sinner, where he just took it to another level. It was like watching a completely different... It was like watching Djokovic play Sinner in the ATP Finals final.
Yeah,
you know,
that was it was and very similar.
So I'm curious to see if he can implement that more often, and even as a plan B now in the future, to help keep his matches more efficient on the way, or just trust that part of his aspect game a little bit more, because we saw him do this in spades back in 2019 in the summer when he came back from two sets to love down against Nadal. We saw him change his tactics, serve and volley. It was kind of a throwback to the old tactical Medvedev. And we also saw him keep his emotions a lot more in check these last couple of weeks, where there was less bending to his entourage. There was more, you know, it was a more mature version. It felt like a conscious effort on his part to really change that and not waste any unnecessary energy emotionally. So I wonder if all these things are going to help him move forward quicker past the defeat this time than a couple of years ago, and if we see this more regularly when he does play the top guys. For instance, next time he plays Alcaraz, you know, and he's taking those returns really early, and if he's doing that against Novak, who serve and volleyed against him repeatedly in their last five or six meetings, especially at the US Open finals. So yeah, these are all just kind of interesting wrinkles in Medvedev's game that I...
Well, they'll all adjust. Novak and Carlos and Sinner will adjust to what if Medvedev continues to throw this more varied game plan at them. But I think it's great that he opened his mind up to it. It's interesting that you brought up 19, because you're right, he was very inventive then, and Rafa should have had him. He was two sets up. He was 4-3 in the third. He looked like he had him for a straight set win, and he kind of let Daniel back in, but then Daniel did start to come in much more. He started to show a lot of colors in his wardrobe, so to speak, and it was impressive. I think we continue to see a lot of that in 20. I thought from 21, despite the fact that he won the Open, there was this crowning moment in his career, that he started to get away from some of the ingenuity that you're referring to and became more rigid and more sort of programmed in how he wanted to play. And now we see a different version. Yeah, and it's exciting to see it. And it's certainly not too late in terms of his age, but his competition is going to be fierce. And that's what makes it so much fun to see, you know, what can he do and what will they do? Because they now will be looking for him. They're going to realize that Medvedev might try out some different things now, that he's going to be willing to experiment more and move around on his return to serve position and sometimes be 16 feet behind the baseline, sometimes be only a few feet. And that he might start really hitting out, because he proved to himself, I don't think he was sure going out there, Vaj, that he could lace his ground strokes with that much velocity, point in, point out for two straight sets and beyond, and hardly make mistakes. And I think Sinner was stunned by that too. It's like, how could he be? He's hitting so much harder. Why is he not making a few more errors? They just were not happening. It just shows you the mechanics are very sound. And that's he must have realized that too. So it's going to be fascinating to see how he approaches it. The other one, of course, it will be in the mix. It's certainly in the non-Grand Slam events is Holger Rune. He has a game that can bother Medvedev as well. So it's going to be very enjoyable to watch him and the three others as the months proceed here and as we head toward the three majors at Roland Garros, Wimbledon, and U.S. Open.
Yeah, of course. And now to talk a little bit more about the final in depth, you know, once Medvedev did sort of get on a roll and go up 6-3, 5-1, and he didn't serve it out the first time of asking in the second set, it kind of did feel like a big shift in the match in terms of the complexion. And of course, you know, when Sinner was serving for it at 5-3, or sorry, Medvedev was serving for it at 5-3, then, you know, Sinner also had a break point then. And once Daniil, you kind of saw at the end of that set, Sinner realized like, oh, you know, he wasn't able to serve it out the first time. Maybe I can make this a lot more physical, and I can, you know, it was interesting to me because Darren Cahill during the broadcast was kind of telling Sinner to fight fire with fire a little bit and continue being more aggressive and send it right back to him. Whereas I have tremendous respect for Cahill as a coach, and he's done wonderful things with Halep and Sinner and, you know, Agassi and the lot. But I was kind of wondering if at that point he should move back a little bit, put some more air under his ground strokes, make Daniil generate a bit more instead of maybe playing perhaps a bit too one speed at times, if I could put it like that, because Daniil is one.
Yeah, I see your point. I hear you on that. It was a tough choice. I'm sure Cahill was as stunned as Sinner at what was going on out there. Not the fact that his player was struggling so mightily, but the game plan of Medvedev. Tough choice to be made. He certainly figured it out. But look, let's go back to 5-1 in a second. Medvedev has served three love games in a row heading into that 5-1 game. He's broken Sinner twice. I thought it was very important for him to bear down hard there and get that set over with. Waste no more energy, waste no more time, and also give Sinner no hope. It wasn't just that he lost his serve. It was actually the first bad game, I would say, that he had played in the two sets. I would classify it that way. It's just not, he didn't have much purpose. He made errors. It was not a good game. Yep. Then, okay, fair enough, Sinner holds. Now you mentioned 5-3. Medvedev is at 40-30 yep. on the 5-3 game. He double faults. So he put himself, he shouldn't have necessarily been in a position to have to save a break point. He managed it. But boy, when they went to their chairs at the change over there after the 6-3 set, they both were thinking, both outlooks had changed on each side of the net. And and I'm sure Medvedev regretted that he didn't put the clamps down as he should have at 5-1. That was to say, I can't say that irrevocably changed the match, but it certainly would have helped Medvedev to have not had to play the extra couple of games, and his confidence would have been higher. Nonetheless, that third set, he stayed with him really nicely up to 4-all. He was getting some pretty comfortable holds. By now, Sinner is serving better, by the way. So it is changing in that sense, but Medvedev is still holding himself. And if I just thought at 4-all deuce, he was kind of distraught by an errant forehand that he made because he drove it long. And it was a ball that he's going to make, I think, 8-9 times out of 10. And if he can stay in that point, win that point, get to break point, he'd be serving for the match and seal the break point. He could have conceivably been serving for the match. And then the double whammy was that he had, when he served at 4-5, he had 40-30 and he couldn't close that game. So those two games combined were devastating for him, because instead of maybe being off the court, it's 2-1 and Sinner has got this growing optimism and he's feeling like, okay, I got out of a jam there. I'm right in this now. I think I can do it. And they go into that fourth set, and by the way, I have to say, I thought it was commendable given the amount of time that Medvedev had spent on the court. And it was as if he had played two more matches than Sinner. It was that many hours.
Yeah, six hours.
So you think about that. That's why I say 6 hours, 3 hours a match. You could, in essence, it was like two more matches. So the fourth set, though, I thought Medvedev did well, despite the fact he was saving break points and success in games. He'd get to 3-all break point.
Yeah,
he did a really nice job there, and you're thinking, boy, this could be one of those classic seventh game of the set being pivotal. And all credit to Sinner for confounding him by not going out wide, which he'd been doing successfully in the outcourt. He's got a great wide serve in the outcourt, and he just went buzzing down the tee at 126 miles an hour for the ace, and then close that out. That was a really crucial hold. I think that, again, must have been tough for Medvedev going to that changeover, thinking that he could have had the break and two holds might have done it. But once again, we see him when he gets to 4-5. You know, I'm thinking each time, the third and fourth sets, when he's getting to 4-5, okay, you feel like he's pretty got a decent chance to maybe at least get it to a tiebreaker. And once again, he has 40-30, but this time Sinner really got him back on his heels with a big forehand and then stepped in for the swing volley winner. And he ends up getting the break again. To think that Medvedev twice at 4-5 lost his serve, you know, would cost him the third and fourth sets. That was very difficult, I think, because he had been having a very good serving day. Fact, I would say it was his best serving of the tournament. Mm-hmm. When you look back at the up and down serving he gave us against Hurkacz and how he early on, not the last three sets against Zverev, because he served well the last three sets, but the first two, he got broken three times in the first set, twice in the second. So he was just very up and down on his serve. Not so against Sinner. He was serving quite well, but to have it happen at 4-5 in each of those sets was tough. And then I thought the first game of the fifth set was pretty important, because Medvedev pushed hard, had him at 15-30, they go to 30-all, he loses 39-stroke rally. and then another ace, I think a second serve ace from Sinner to go to one love in the fifth. And I had the feeling then that Medvedev was going to be hard pressed to stay in here. And he played a very kind of a convoluted, not with the same purpose and aggression we'd seen from him when he lost his serve at 2-3. It was kind of a giveaway game. And Sinner took full advantage, served out to 5-2, and then held for the match. A little tension when he served for the match, but he didn't let it get out of hand. He didn't face a break point and wins the match with that gorgeous forehand down the line, and rifled it down the line for a winner, a classic Sinner forehand winner. And so I think they both took something away from it. I agree with you on that. They both took something away, but for Medvedev, it would have been the most gratifying tournament of his career, probably, and one of the more astonishing majors. If we would have put it up there, maybe even higher than, say, Carlos winning his 3-5 setters at the 22 Open, where he saved a match point against Sinner at the U.S. Open, and then obviously he'd already gone 5 with Cilic, and he went 5 with Tiafoe, and he eventually won the final in 4. That was fantastic, as was Edberg, the 92 Open, where he had 3 successive matches without a break in the fifth before beating Pete Sampras in the final. So, there have been some phenomenal efforts in that regard, with guys winning a bunch of 5 setters and still being able to pull out the final. If Medvedev had done that after all of the arduous fortnight that he'd endured, it would have been fantastic. On the other hand, he's definitely in a better place than he was last September.
Yeah, that's a pretty good assessment of all the key moments, honestly, in the third, fourth, and fifth, and where the match flipped. I also thought that Sinner did a really good job with his backhand down the line at points in the third and fourth set. He also did a really good job when it came to winning the longer rallies against Medvedev. Yes. And kind of waiting him out on those, especially the 39-shot rally that he played at,
Yeah, in that first game in the fifth. Yeah, that's why I mentioned that. And it was significant. You're right. And it also gets back to your point, Vansh. In some ways, he wanted to show Daniel, okay, I can, I know you're feeling it, so I'm going to stay with you. I'm going to make you feel every long rally. You're going to know that you are being punished, not by me, but by the length, by the fact that I'm staying in there and I'm going to hang in the rally with you. And I think I can win these exchanges. And they had many in the match, but that was probably the most important one. And it was a kind of a crushing blow to Medvedev at that stage, who desperately wants to get up a break in the fifth after losing the hard-fought third and fourth sets.
Yeah, and of course, you referenced the matches that they played at the end of last year with Sinner winning those three in the autumn. And I think those are very key in this. Those are very key in this match if you look at it as a whole, because in Beijing, when we saw them play, and there was a couple of tie breaks then that Sinner won, I felt like that was Sinner showcasing his improved variety and his improved sort of court sense with the serving and volleying and forehand drop shot. And we saw that there were wrinkles in his game along with the improved serve. But in Vienna and at the ATP Finals, we saw him actually really outlast Daniil from the back of the court and trust his consistency from the baseline. And it didn't used to always be like that with Jannik, because you didn't always used to trust that he'd make those forehands under pressure and that maybe he'd overhead on some occasions from the baseline. And I feel like that's still not the case. The controlled aggression is taking that to a whole nother level.
He has, Vansh, and he did. By the way, you mentioned Vienna. I thought he also did essentially the same thing in Turin. He out-rallied him there. Now, it is a different... It's fascinating. The other thing we must allude to here, Medvedev and all of that. So sometimes these players talk about what they want to do, talk about wanting to change themselves. Medvedev did that in talking about his demeanor and what he was thinking about in the offseason, controlling his emotions. Aside from one dangerous moment, by the way, and I'm sure you saw it against Ruusuvuori when he went down 5-4 in the fourth on serve, but he was upset because he knew he was going to have to serve to stay in the match and didn't think he should have been in that position, and he was mad that he'd lost the first two sets. So he flung that racket at the chair at the changeover that could so easily have bounced up and hit somebody in the box seats. It could have been a disqualification moment, reminiscent in some ways of what happened to Djokovic at the 2020 Open, but worse in a way because Novak was sort of a casual, not looking, careless.
Yeah.
And where he kind of hit a ball. He didn't throw his racket. He was smacking a ball that hit that lineswoman. So Daniel could have had a similar moment here. But aside from that, He was completely I thought he did a great job. And when he knew he was upset, he did it, took his bathroom breaks at the end of sets. He did that against Erkosh. That was smart. Gave himself a chance to cool off, not only physically, but emotionally. So I feel like he may live up to the hopes that he has for himself, and feeling he's better off to stay calmer. Because let's face it, he has at times gotten in his own way with his venting, and it has not done him any good. And he bickers with his coach. His coach, we've had this history of the coach leaving matches a few times because he doesn't want to take the abuse. And he doesn't need to do that to himself or the people around him. And I feel like that's the other thing that's going to be interesting. Does he maintain that composure the rest? Because again, then you'd maybe that's part of the reason why he did so well and stayed so physically strong through the whole tournament, right up until the middle of the fifth set, you could argue the final. And I think part of it is he wasn't wasting the energy with unnecessary, explosions, verbal explosions or venting at his corner.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I hope he keeps that composure because, frankly, we're still seeing the great size of his personality in the on-court interviews and in the press conferences. And I don't think he needs that stuff on the court. And it certainly doesn't seem to be helping him.
No, and he doesn't. And he said something like, I'm not saying that I want to be a better person because I don't know what that means. But it was an interesting comment. It was kind of like, no, I just want to be different. I want to do myself more justice. He's quite cerebral in his way. And now it's going to be a question of easier said than done. We got it in one tournament. But what if some frustrating things start happening in Indian Wells or Miami? Will he handle it as well? Well, we'll find out. But I think he saw the benefits, Sponge, in this tournament of being able to contain his emotions. And let's hope that he can maintain that.
Yeah, of course. And it seems to always be the case whenever he plays Zverev that in the crunch moments, when it always comes down to this deciding tie breaks or the final set, or in many cases like Indian Wells and Monte Carlo last year, for instance, their matches. And other situations, it's just you back to Neil to be a bit more clutch in those moments and situations. And he kind of, proved that again against Zverev, who was so close to winning this match and essentially had two serves on his racket at 5-4 in the
first. Yeah, he did.
And also two sets of love. And, there were so many precarious situations here for Daniil. And I thought he handled it very well, of course. And then we saw Zverev fade away physically, understandably, in the fifth. And Daniil played a smart fifth set then. So what do you sort of make of this rivalry? Because they've had so many matches and only this is their first one in a major. And
I see it. I agree with you. From his end of the court, it's been commendable because he won 5 out of 6 last year. It could easily have been a split. And you mentioned Indian Wells, you mentioned Monte Carlo. I mean, he had his opportunities. He should have won a couple more times in my view, Zara, but Daniil was tremendous under duress.
Yeah.
But from Zverev's end, I think you probably heard him. He was making some comments in advance of this contest, basically trying to say that a lot of those matches last year, he was working his way back to the top of his game. Fair enough, because of what had happened to him the year before at the French. But unfortunately, this was almost a carbon copy of a lot of those other matches where he put himself in a position to win. I wouldn't have thought it would have happened from two sets up. From two sets to one, maybe. But to have managed to kind of squeeze out the first set where they had 5 service breaks and get tucked that one away 7-5 and win a relatively easy second, I wouldn't have thought it would get away from him. And as you say, then we go to, you look at how close he was. The third set, Medvedev is serving at 3-4, love 30. And, if Zverev can break him there, he's serving for the match. Then, okay, a 7-4 tiebreaker that was locked at 4 points all. Then we go to the fourth, go to that tie. And again, there was a 4-all love 30 for Medvedev. He got out of that. But we go to the tiebreaker, and that's where what you're alluding to is that the double fault from Medvedev gave Zverev the chance just be serving at 5-4. And at 5-4, not much he could have done because Medvedev stepped around and did an excellent inside-out forehand that set up an easy, easy forehand winner off the next shot. But at 5-all, Medvedev was the first to admit some good luck. He moved in closer. He was on the return, but he had to go to that chip forehand return that barely made it over the net. And poor Zverev, there was no way he could make a play. that was a stunning moment and one of great fortune for Medvedev and bad luck for Zverev. And then Medvedev serves an ace to take the set. And you did have the feeling then that it was over, and it was. You know, it was a pretty clear cut this set. But I have to be critical of Zverev because I this happens too often. You think back to the 2020 U.S. Open race, two sets up against Dominic Thiem, and he serves for the match in the fifth. And tiebreak is incredibly close, but he just doesn't seem really, it too often he doesn't be seem to be able to get it done under pressure. And I wonder whether this is just going to be a career long issue for him, whether it's something he'll never fully got. I hope I'm wrong. I think he's so worthy with his game of winning a major or two, but I'm not sure he's got the psyche for it.
Yeah, I have the same doubts about that as you. In terms of, I guess let's talk about the other semifinal with Djokovic and Sinner, of course. Djokovic just comes out really, really flat, makes 29 unforced errors in the first couple of sets. Sinner playing well, but nothing spectacular, kind of within himself, composed, you know, serving great. And Djokovic plays a very good first point of the match, and you're thinking, okay, game on. But then the entirety of the last two sets, Djokovic never really found his range. And of course, this was a day match, and I'm sure the wind played a factor more so than the heat in this situation. But nonetheless, it was very strange to see Djokovic have like no spark, no intensity, and let that linger for those two sets. And he kind of found his level in the third, but in terms of his serving, but to see him never get to break point was certainly very jarring.
All valid points. It was perplexing, to say the least. It was perplexing. I've seen reports on the internet today. You never know what to make of this because people put this stuff out there. I don't even know who they are. Somebody's saying that he might have had it, that even though he'd been battling a virus up until then, that he might have gotten a flu overnight leading into this match. I don't know. I don't buy that necessarily, but I definitely think something was wrong. Because as you alluded to, it wasn't just that he made the 29 unforced. It wasn't just that he never got to break point. He was clearly not getting the better of those shorter points. Sinner was out hitting him, but Novak, until the third set, we didn't see him really extend some of the rallies in a way that was beneficial to himself. And I thought that finally Sinner, that was the one set where he had more unforced errors than Novak, because in the first two it was 29-8, but 15-13, Sinner versus Djokovic in the third. And part of that was that Djokovic settled down, backed up his serve one, started opening up the court and orchestrating points the way we have grown accustomed to seeing him do. And he wasn't able to do it on Sinner's serve because the returns just weren't sharp enough, so he couldn't get into those. But on his own serve, he was able to do that. And then, of course, rescued himself a match point down in the breaker. Had a little bit of luck there, but he played a good breaker, and if that could have gone either way, but he won it 8-6. And I still didn't think he really believed he was going to win, and we saw him lose his serve from 40 love at 1-2 in the fourth, which was, at that point, was like the final nail in the coffin. But something was fundamental. You summed it up well. Sinner was solid in those first two sets. He only made 8 unforced errors combined in the two sets, but he wasn't being tested. He wasn't being pushed. And you kept waiting for Djokovic to either get really angry or at least get animated in some way. And it happened late in the second. He tried to get the crowd a little involved. He was trying to avoid going down two breaks, which didn't happen, as by the way. But it still was not the Djokovic we know, who with the sense of urgency. I didn't see the sense of urgency. It was just slipping by, and somehow, and you could see the kind of hopeless, helpless expressions on in his corner with Goran Ivanišević and the other people in his camp, because they didn't feel like there was anything they could do to pull him out of this predicament in the state of mind that he was in. So didn't surprise me that he didn't win the four, for two reasons: that Sinner was so composed himself and not panicking and still serving, still holding comfortably, not facing break points, and that Djokovic just didn't look. He still didn't have that look like, okay, I've got this now. You know, there's no way you're going to stop me. That sort of defiant streak in him was missing. The spark was missing. So I do think, although that report seems weird because he didn't look like he had an all-out flu, that he would, because he moved okay, not his best, but it wasn't terrible. He wasn't calling for a trainer. He wasn't looking drained at the changeovers, but he was listless. He was He just had no the energy and the inspiration combined that we usually see from him in these big matches. Just, you would have thought that this was some kind of a second round match in Dubai. It just was shocking in that regard. And Sinner sensed it, Bunch, and that's where I give him high marks. He sensed it and didn't let it kind of distract him. It was almost like he was saying, wow, something's a little wrong with Novak, but I'm not going to worry myself with that. I'm just going to do my job, which he did very, very well. I don't understand why at 58% first serve percentage for Sinner that Djokovic couldn't have had more openings and more chase. Should have been able to do more. The depth on his returns was not up to normal, certainly on first serve returns, but he didn't even do as good a job as usual on the second serve returns. And when service games of your opponent are flying by that quickly and you're barely getting to deuce, maybe a couple of times at deuce, then that just put him under a kind of pressure he didn't need. And I just think it everything sort of spiraled on him. Everything got out of hand, and he did well to take the set. At least he salvages. It could easily, he was down break point at the start of the third. It could ended up being a 1-2 and 4 match, which would have been even harder to take. But on the other hand, he doesn't get, there's no real encouragement in losing 6-1, 6-2, 6-7, 6-3. You know, you still feel like you were soundly beaten. And given the fact that the two matches that he lost to Jannik late last year in that 12-day.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Span that they played three matches where he won that finals of Turin so convincingly, but lost a tiebreaker in the third to Sinner in the round robin at Turin. And then when they played the last time of the year in Davis Cup, Sinner was serving at 4-5, love 40 in that final set, triple match point down. So it's hard to understand how you could go from that, where clearly he showed he had the ability to beat Novak and close matches, to something like this that was just completely one-sided for two sets. And it, to me, it was just the willpower, determination, professionalism of Djokovic that enabled him to salvage the one set. His pride kicked in, and he didn't want to leave the court a straight set loser, and he didn't. But that was sort of a small potatoes for him. There wasn't any large satisfaction in just getting the one set. So it was confounding to me that he could have come out and started like that, and not just a bad first set. I could see that it happened in the U.S. Open a bunch of times in 2021 before he lost to Medvedev in the final. But then something kicks in by the start of the second, and you feel like he's starting anew, and he's put that behind him, and he's determined to drive himself into the match. It didn't come close to happening here. And you can't spot Sinner a two set lead like that. It was asking too much to come back from two sets to love down against a 22-year-old who's this good, who's going to be a contender for number one in the world this year. You can't give him that kind of leeway.
Yeah, for sure. And it was also surprising to see when it was 1-2, you know, and 40 love, and he tries one shot, and it was a very good drop shot. Sinner got to it and countered it with a really nice forehand redrop angle of his own. And then after that, Djokovic just really gave away the rest of the game with unforced errors, four in a row.
They did.
That was proof,
Bunch, that he didn't believe. I mean, again, you would have thought by 40, 30 or deuce, you would have seen that kind of that look, that sense of anger or defiance or the resoluteness. It wasn't there. The game just slipped away and that's, again, that's unlike him, to let a big moment like that where you have to keep holding in the fourth and at least see if you can get into another tiebreak. But he knew I think somewhere deep down, he just knew he didn't have it that day. And he was good in the press conference afterwards at talking about, explaining about the wrist and the virus and not using them as real excuses, but that he had never felt like the point being, he never felt like he was at his best in this tournament. Okay, but we have seen that many times where he hasn't necessarily been at his absolute best in the earlier rounds. He's dropping sets. U.S. Open last year, he had the five-setter down two sets to his countryman, Jera. Give me that pronunciation again.
Jera.
I always want to use the D. Jera has him down two sets. He wins that in five. We've seen isolated days. And then he snaps out of it and he gets back. I did think after the first two rounds here, Vaj, that he played nicely against Echeverry, I guess 3-3 and 6. And, never looked like he was going to give. He was very comfortable on serve and probably could have closed it out sooner, but plays a good tiebreak to end it. And then the two love sets against Mannarino and a straight set win. And finally, Taylor Fritz, which was in very extreme heat. So it was kind of understandable to me that the first two sets he was looking a bit wobbly at times because he hates those exceedingly hot days. And it was better for him when they got into the evening, and in the last two sets he looked better. But I certainly didn't think he played a bad match. It's just that there were 15 break points that eluded him over the first two sets, and would have made life a lot easier if he could have converted a couple of those along the way. But I still felt coming out of the Fritz match that he would take it up a notch against Sinner. And I think most of his longtime admirers thought the same thing. And I've got to believe that he did. So the mystery is, why was he so far off? Not that he lost, but to lose that way. And why was he almost unrecognizable those first two sets?
Yeah, I thought after the third and fourth set against Fritz that, he would be able to sort of flip that switch and raise that level and those first two couple of sets at least more competitive. I mean, it is worth noting, of course, he had the wrist issues coming into the tournament as well, and there was definitely a factor in his loss to Dimitrov at the United Cup, and we saw it bother him a little bit along with the cold and sickness in the early rounds, and his forehand looked very shaky against Prismic at times, and especially against Popperin, where, he almost went down two sets to one. But like you said, I mean, we've seen him drop sets early on in first weeks before, and it happened like...
But I also thought in those first couple of rounds that there was something still going on with the wrist. I really did. I didn't like the way he was hitting his forehand in those first two matches.
Yep.
There was something a bit inhibited about it. And you felt like there were times he could have unloaded it and unleashed it the way he has done so well the last few years. And there was a certain caution and certain inhibition. So I felt like that was part of what was going on in those two matches. But then I felt like from Echeverry on, physically, I didn't see any signs left of the wrist being an issue, and I thought the forehand was much better. And I thought he was perfectly positioned to peak, and that they'd have another great match. I mean, obviously, Sinner was in sparkling form himself the whole tournament, but it was quite remarkable the way it unfolded those two sets. And I'm sure he'll be analyzing it, trying to figure it out. I certainly think he'll come back with a real... When you lost three of the last four to a key rival like that, you really want to make a move. You'll want to sort of get back at him, not in a personal way, but he'll want to reestablish himself in the rivalry and say, hey, don't think you've got me now, because you don't. And it'll be really interesting to see how he plays and how well his nerve holds up whenever they next meet, whether that happens to be Indian Wells or Miami or somewhere in the clay court campaign or Roland Garros, who knows what, if they could meet a bunch of times conceivably. But I do think it's very important for Djokovic to kind of get back in there. I thought it was important when he beat him in the finals of Turin because he didn't want to lose to him twice in a week. And then a bit jarring when he lost Davis Cup, but it was just it was almost freakish. It was phenomenal what Sinner did. But how many times could Djokovic lose to anybody when he's got triple match point, and even a big server? So I feel like now it's reached a kind of a crucial juncture for him, and it'll be really, I, I think he'll respond well. I mean, I think he now will start to treat Sinner in his mind the way he started to treat Carlos in his mind last year, where he began to look at Carlos as a really key rival. And he took the he didn't like losing that Wimbledon final, and he fought back to win that stupendous clash in Cincinnati where he saved a match point and eventually won it in a third set tiebreak, then beat him again at the end of the year. But you could tell how much respect he had for Carlos. He now surely has the same kind of respect for Sinner and has to look at Sinner as being on exactly the same level at this point, maybe above,
yep,
and look at him as his, maybe right now, as his foremost rival.
Yeah, I totally agree with all that. It'd also be interesting to see what Sinner does on clay because...
Yes. Yeah.
We've seen him make a Roland Garros quarterfinal in 2020 and play rough or really tight. And last year he was in Monte Carlo, and he's certainly very capable on the clay. But we just haven't seen it for a full stretch yet. And I assume he'll be pretty successful on all surfaces because his game just feels that well-rounded right now.
I completely agree. There's no reason why he can't do better on clay than he did this past year and the last couple of years. And no, it's not necessarily going to be his best service, but there's no reason he can't perform well on clay. But certainly the upcoming hard court tournaments, he's going to be a tough man to beat, Indian Wells and Miami. And certainly again, back on the grass, he showed at Wimbledon what he could do there, getting to the semis, losing to Djokovic. And then there'll be a long stretch on hard courts over the summer, right through the U.S. Open and indoors in the fall. So there's, even if he doesn't have a great clay court campaign, and I think he will do okay, but even if he doesn't, I think he's going to do so well everywhere else that will, he'll compensate for it if that's the case.
Yeah, for sure. And then, of course, we still have to talk about Alcaraz, who, got to the quarters and, obviously his first time being in Australian Open as a top contender in a couple of years because he missed it last year due to injury. But for him, he looked so good against Kecmanovic in the fourth round there. And, I was kind of anticipating that he would carry that form on into the quarters against Zverev. I was expecting certainly a much tougher match than when Zverev and Carlos faced off at the U.S. Open, of course, because Zverev was still feeling it physically after the match against Sinner. Tight five-setter that those two had there, but in this match, I was sort of surprised by it. I was sort of surprised by both things happening at the same time. In a way, kind of similar to the Novak match in terms of its trajectory and how it went the first couple of sets, but this time it was Zverev just serving lights out, like 85%.
Wow, you said it. Yeah, that's the key. He was serving lights out. Carlos couldn't get on track. Carlos was a bit wild off the ground at times. I can understand why he, and the thing was that Zverev was so good also from the baseline. The great serving gave him a little extra confidence in his ground game, and he fed off of Carlos's pace. His forehand was about as good as I've ever seen it for a match of that length of four sets. And it was particularly good going down the line, approaching down the line off that forehand. He just had such certitude when it came to the forehand.
Yeah.
But you're right. Let's get back to Carlos. You're right in the sense you still don't expect to see him lose two sets, 1 and 3. He had his opening in the middle of the second set to go up a break, and he couldn't take it. And then Zverev ran out that set. Carlos did a wonderful job of hanging in the third from 5-2 down. Zverev serves sort of 5-3 and two aces took him to 30 all. I thought he might end it there, but Carlos didn't panic. He got the break and he held from 15-30, and they go to the breaker. And Carlos played an extraordinary tiebreak after losing the first 2 points. He won 7 points in a row, 5 of them with outright winners. There wasn't anything Zverev could have done about that, but then it was a good effort from Zverev after they exchanged breaks at the start of the fourth to run out the match from 3-4, because at 3-4 he had 40-love and Carlos got it back to deuce. It was dangerous. Zverev managed to fend him off in that game and then closed it out.
Yeah,
it was important. I think it was important for Carlos. It feels a little better than if he'd been blown out 1-3 and 3.
Yeah.
But he was expecting more of himself. He lost to Zverev. You and I had talked about it at the time. I remember we were texting. It's a good match he played against, that Zverev played against Carlos, the opening round robin match in Turin. And he beat him in three sets there. That gave Zverev some confidence, I think. And then historically now he's done quite well against him. And I think Carlos has a great respect for him, but It was tough. You're right. It had been a fairly easy run. One tough match that went to 7-6 in the fourth. He did beat Kecmanovic easily. But the draw, I don't know, maybe he wasn't tested enough. Maybe it would have been good for him to play Tommy Paul instead of Kecmanovic, because we did think we were going to get that match. Now, I'm not saying he wouldn't necessarily have beaten Tommy, but let's say he played a really good four setter with him and won it. It might have carried him into Zverev feeling more ready. We'll never know. But I what I do know is he's going to snap out of this. I just don't have any doubt, because he's so gifted and so determined that he's had a tough struggle here since not winning a tournament since Wimbledon. But we've seen him, the epic with Novak in Cincinnati, the semis of the U.S. Open, where Medvedev played a sensational match and which was impressive given that Daniel had lost so badly to Carlos, Indian Wells, and Wimbledon. So, okay, but it was still a semi, and semis of the year-end championships, he loses to Novak, and quarters here. So he's not that far off. I'm convinced he'll find the winning formula again pretty soon, and he'll be determined to, because he was winning tournaments left and right prior through Wimbledon. Now, I thought he might end up winning 8 to 10 tournaments for the year the way he was going, and it didn't happen. But I do think it's just a matter of time. Also, Vaj, he played with some injuries. He might have come back a bit too soon last fall. I had that feeling. Maybe he shouldn't have played Paris. I could be wrong, but I think there's been different factors where he hasn't been physically 100% at times, and definitely right now mentally. He's a little off his mental game too, because he's got an interesting personality, and he can get very cocky. When things are going right, he can get very cocky in the best sense of the word. Where I see Sinner the same way, when they're at the top of their games, you know, there's unmistakable confidence and conviction in what they're doing, and they don't care who's on the other side of the net. Carlos will get that back, don't you think? And soon,
I think so too. Also, because he's going to be going back to South American clay, and sort of, I think that will also maybe help him construct points a little bit better. Because also, you know, it takes away not having a great day on your serve, like also as well, you know, first serve doesn't become as important. And also he's going to be determined, because he won all those tournaments last year, and he went 47-4 from February all the way to the end of Wimbledon. So
yeah, right.
And I definitely think so, because he isn't that far off. At the same time, you know, he's got work to do and stuff to work on in his game, and it'll be fun to sort of evolve with it'll be fun to sort of watch him evolve along with Sinner and Djokovic and Medvedev. But I guess
I think the serve of you're right. That pressure, that layer of pressure is removed when he gets back out on the clay, because it won't be as important. But I think when he returns to the hard courts, I like to see him serving bigger again. I like to see. I think that he and Juan Carlos need to address that, because there's some matches. I mean, like the Zverev match, where as great as Zverev served and played, because he was magnificent both on serve and from the baseline, Carlos needs to do a better job of holding. You got to at least literally hold up your end of the bargain and stay with him. And he got blitzed in the first, and you know, then and again in the second, lost the serve a couple more times in the fourth. It's like you at this level, you can't get away with that. I don't think. I don't think he can, at least. And so I think that needs to be addressed. You know, I'd like to see him get back to the point where it's pretty hard to break him in a match, where you know. He loses, you know, maybe in a four-set match, he only loses his serve once. I'd like to see more of that from Carl. More dominance on serve, more easy holds, and fewer breaks.
Yeah, for sure. The first serve efficiency is like the one thing you can point to in Alcaraz's game that's kind of lagging behind the rest of it. Also, I'd also like to see him be a bit more patient and rely on that superior speed and athleticism, you know, that he possesses. And he's just such a shot maker and entertainer, and he's got this, like, you know, flashy way of playing, and then sometimes perhaps that gets in his way a little bit, but it's also what makes him the great player that he is. So
yeah, the only thing I would change what you just said is I wouldn't use the word perhaps. I think it definitely does. But I think he understands it. He has this,
but he had this really great balance at Wimbledon, for instance, where I thought he was a bit better. And he was being more efficient, and you know, he had this ability, like against Djokovic in the final, to get those returns back into play and, you know, win some of those longer exchanges and trust his legs more and rely on that part of his game, because he's so fast. And so
No, that was a big factor in Wimbledon, that after the first set, when Djokovic beat him so comfortably 6-1, that he started getting many more returns back in play. But that was because he didn't try to do so much with it. Yeah. And he didn't worry about hitting, giving eye candy to the crowd, so to speak.
Exactly.
And that's always been he's been susceptible to that. And it's kind of an endearing quality in some ways that he wants to please the crowd that much. But obviously, the first priority has to be, I'm out here to win. There'll be plenty of time to make the highlight reels, and I'll make my, automatically, because of my shot making capabilities, I'll pull some of those off those will be nice moments. But I've got to pay attention to the bread and butter too. And some of it has to just be the basics and the percentages and doing what's going to help me win. But I think in the back of his mind, he knows that, and he'll rediscover that, because we saw some of that. I saw plenty of that from him when he went, and not just in Wimbledon last year, but in that 22 Opens. Yes, difficult matches, difficult moments, but when he had to buckle down, he did. And I'm confident that he'll sort of rediscover the winning formula soon enough.
Yep, that's a good way of putting it. I guess a couple of other players I wanted to mention, Taylor Fritz. He had a great tournament. A little bit dangerous in his first match against Facundo Diaz Acosta, where he turned his ankle and then,
Right.
That was another one of those, oh no, Taylor's going to lose in the first round of a major again. But now that's back-to-back majors where he's made the quarters, and this time he really equipped himself nicely against Novak, and many of those break points came up with really brilliant shots on his backhand especially, and that's some of the best two sets. I think that's the best he's ever played against Djokovic. I think so, because I don't think you can take the 2021 match and say that was better than this one.
The only one that came close to this was Turin in the semis.
Yeah.
At the end of 22, where he took him to two tie breaks. So it was a pretty well played too. But this was better. This was even better. And I agree. Second straight quarter, high quality. Actually, what I think happened was that because he paid the price for the back. You're right that on the break points he was phenomenal at times in his ability to just sort of forget about the pressure and go for it. And his backhand he was surprising Djokovic by coming up with these big shots, because Novak thought it was going to be enough to just play a nice deep return down the middle and work the point and coax some kind of an error, but that was not happening. So he fends off those 15 break points across the first two sets, and it was almost every other service game that Taylor was under this kind of duress. But then by the time we got to early in the third, I think he was physically spent. I think Novak had, he had worn himself out. Novak had worn him out, because I think there was a big difference in his legs and the quality of his play. And then Djokovic also stepped his level up. But I agree. Listen, he also beat Tsitsipas. It was a good win for Taylor. And so I feel like this was vindication for everything that's gone on with him the last couple of years. And any of us who might have been saying that maybe he had, his peak work was done. And no, I think at this point, I see him sort of hanging around the bottom of the top 10. If he made a move higher, I would be very impressed. But I certainly think he can hold his ground, because that was a more impressive major than the U.S. Open last year by far.
Yeah, by far. And then he's got the sport hand drop shot as well, which I like that he's using that a lot more, because he's ended up coming forward. But I like the addition to that as well. And he's of course got the fighting spirit. The backhand is great. One of the best ball strikers. Obviously, he's never going to be an elite mover, but he's done the best that he can in terms of maximizing those abilities as well. And I love the Tsitsipas matchup for him. For him, it's a good matchup, just because he can target that. It's a kind of an easy kind of game plan for him to implement in his mind. He might not always win, but I think, he definitely showcased that, that was his first time ever beating a top 10 player in a major. So,
right. No, I was impressive. And Tsitsipas had been finding some form after the first round. And so coming into it, I was giving him a slight edge, because I thought that he was back and it's always been his best major, and he's the runner-up last year. And so I was giving him the slight edge. And Taylor ended up winning fairly comfortably in four sets. It was a great effort. So, yes, he should come away feeling very good about himself and ready to move on with the rest of the year successfully. And I could see him even having slightly better results than he did in 2023 based on this form. And you mentioned the mobility. I for him, that's as well as I've ever seen him move. And I think he's also getting more aggressive on his back and missing fewer forehands. his level was quite high.
It was for sure. And of course, we're still waiting for that Grand Slam breakthrough for Holger Rune. He's showing it in best of three, first half of last year all the way till Wimbledon, then got hurt with his back. And then, you know, we didn't really see him put it together again until, you know, a couple of good showings in the Paris and ATP finals. And, you know, this one, this just kind of showed that he's got some work to do still, like, you know, physically and mentally, just too many ups and downs and dips in terms of his overall level, and came up against a really inspired opponent in Arthur Kazan in the second round. But you do sort of wonder, is he going to be able to manage his emotions and nerves and the physical issues that we keep seeing him have in the other three majors this year, or if it's just he's got to take his time to grow, just like Sinner, and maybe in 2 or 3 years he'll be winning a major.
Yeah, but I think, Fudge, I always thought that Sinner, he's had some moments in the majors, some disappointing performances in the majors up until Wimbledon last year, but I never worried too much about him in best of five. I still worry a lot about Rune.
Right.
And here's another example. And it's he ended last year, as you know, he was playing much better tennis once Becker came aboard. And you know, he played a great match. He played really quite well against both Novak and Sinner, even though he lost those matches in Turin. I thought he'd recovered the form that made him such a standout in the first half of the year. So, and I still think he can get that back. And no reason to, in the Indian Wells and Miami and certainly on the clay, that he can't do some great things again. But I'd like to see him be more of a factor. I mean, he did play well at Wimbledon to get to the quarters, and then Carlos took care of him pretty comfortably and straight. Didn't play a terribly good match there.
Yeah.
But I that was almost an exception to the rule. I'd like to see him. He should be somebody that's a threat at the majors. Right now, he has not yet shown us that, but he should be. So it's going to be very revealing what he does in the last three majors of this year. Oh, somewhere along the line, he's at least in a semi.
Yeah, for sure. Because now you see Yannick win and Carlos win, and you better believe that he's, you know, going to want to be getting up there in terms of them. And professionally, of course, you know, with those rivalries.
Yes, I agree. And he sees himself, you know, in the same room as them.
Right.
Among the elite, but he's got to prove it now. And the ability's there. We've seen him play fantastic best of three set matches. But I want to see now. I was disappointed in this one. I thought we'd see more from him in Australia than we did. And hopefully across the coming months, he's gonna figure some things out. And Becker could help.
Yeah. And of course, speaking of figuring things out, my God, has Aryna Sabalenka gone through a really, really great transformation the last couple of years. I mean, from double faulting left, right, and center at the start of 2022, and, you know, a serving underarm, to now displaying this controlled aggression, you know, on the biggest stages, and so consistent in the last six majors, getting to the semis every time and putting herself in these positions at all four majors. And I mean, you have to say right now, this kind of level, I guess, you know, particularly the impressive match being the one that she played against Coco and reversing that result at the US Open, but also just the way she barely dropped games in a lot of these matches, and, you know, was so impressive in the final. And what did you sort of make of her 2 weeks here in Melbourne? Because it was really dominant.
You summed it up beautifully. I thought the moment of truth, you might say, was that what was the end of the first set against Coco. It was coming from 2-5 down, the lead 6-5, 30 love. Coco got a bit surprised by a deep return down the middle from Sabalenka, and she sort of framed it off her forehand. And then she missed a few more shots, had a couple other forehand errors later in the game that were costly. And good effort, but what it also shook. So I'm a little critical of Coco for not serving it out, but I'm even more impressed the way Sabalenka maintained her composure and then carried it in and through the tiebreak, where she played nearly an impeccable tiebreak. And then they go to 4-all in the second, and she runs it out from there. She's so mature now. You kind of alluded to the key points with her. This is somebody that was completely confounded on her serve, and getting the likes of Philippoussis, anybody she could find to try to help her with the serve, she did. She was at a crossroads. She solved that. She barely serves doubles anymore. You said you use the phrase controlled aggression, which is the perfect way to describe her ground game. Because now, you know, she's hitting out freely, making very few errors. There's no reason, Vansh, that Sabalenka can't win at least one more major this year. It's possible two, but I think more likely one. Asking her to win two is asking maybe too much, but I expect her, I guess, based on this form and assuming there's no injuries, given the consistency you alluded to with these last six majors in the semis, I expect her to finish this year ahead of Iga at number one in the world.
Yeah, it's a strange one because Iga is so consistent at tour level, and that's she has the edge over Arena when it comes to getting the year number one, like we saw last year. But Sabalenka in these majors, like every single one, semis are higher, and it just seems like the reliability is greater with her right now than Iga, who's, you know, still susceptible to those early round major defeats.
Yes, but he wins. It's a good point about week in, week out with Iga. It's true. But conversely, if Sabalenka does pull off another major, and then maybe she's in the finals and semis of the other two, or two, you know, something along those lines, which is very likely, she's going to have a lot of points just from that alone. And as long as she can turn in some pretty decent performances elsewhere, shoot, it went right down to the wire last year, let's face it. And then the year-end championship, since she loses to her there, I mean, it was hanging in the balance. So I kind of give her the slight edge this year, given that she's now won her second straight Australian. So she's feeling that was such validation, Bodge, to get this title and win her second major. And it means she's almost certainly one day going to end up in the Hall of Fame. And I can't imagine, never mind this year, for a few more years, she's going to have a bunch of major titles in her collection. And it's impressive to see it because she was so frantic is the word I always think of with her. You just felt like she could implode at any time in her matches. And the serve was such a serious issue with her. And then when that would happen, it would carry over into her ground game. You know, it's understandable. It would be sort of a domino effect, but that's gone now. That's totally gone. The stability. Now, I never thought I would use that word, but I see a lot of stability in Sabalenka right now.
I mean, she hit over 470 serves, Steve, in this entire tournament, and she hit 10 double faults.
Well, there you go. Seven matches. So that's an average of barely over one double a match. I mean, that was inconceivable a couple of years ago. She should be very proud of it because she's not babying the second serve either, by the way. She's it's not that easily attackable. It maybe isn't the best second serve in the world, but it's decent. So to serve so few, I mean, and that's I don't see that changing. I just don't see it changing. I think she's conquered it now to the point where she can count on it. And then that allows her to operate with a lot more freedom and in a more relaxed manner from the baseline. And then she just has off both wings. She's just devastatingly potent and now purposeful, not just potent, but purposeful.
Yeah, I mean, and these rivalries with Coco and Iga especially are going to be so much fun to watch.
They are
going to play many more times this year, and we're going to see some of the best.
Yeah, and by the way, Gavaj, Coco should not be discouraged. She didn't play her best this tournament, but she's in the semis. She's competitive. She actually said that she thought she played better against Sabalenka here than she did at the U.S. Open. And so I feel like she again can come away with a feeling of like, look, I'm gonna get a major this year somewhere. And actually, I think Coco will be very competitive at Roland Garros, where she's been in the final before, and she's very comfortable on the clay. She's got a shot there. She's got a shot anywhere. So I feel like I'm glad she didn't go out early. I'm glad she didn't lose that nerve wracking quarterfinal. She takes her place in the semis and loses to the woman who right now is the best woman player in the world. Forget the rankings. Right now, she's the best.
Yeah, for sure. And then, of course, Zhang Shenwen did a great job taking advantage of, you know, that top half of the draw and really taking care of the pressure that was on her. You know, once Rybakina lost, Swiatek lost, Pegula lost, Ondrosova lost. So it was good to see that sort of level of consistency pay off for Zhang Shenwen, because she's a real talent. Obviously, the serve is a double-edged sword with her, because she hits that, you know, she has that little bit of a hitch in her service motion, and she hits a lot of aces, but also a lot of doubles. And she's clearly very, very talented, works extremely hard. And like since Wimbledon, all of her losses have been like Sabalenka, Rybakina, Iga. So just shows you that level of consistency. And she didn't face anyone in the top 50. And perhaps maybe this came ahead of schedule for her. This is kind of like, you know, Goff getting to the 2022 French Open final for me. So I think we'll see the best of her in a year or two from now. But this was This was a really good first step, and she did get.
Yeah, it's a first step. I'm not sure she's headed for the same territory as Goff, but and maybe so. But you're right; it's a very. She took full advantage of a wide open draw. I frankly think we get a little too much of that in the women's game. I'd like to see the top ones be a bit more reliable. But what I think will happen the rest of this year is we know that Iga is thoroughly professional. She'll bounce back from this. She'll have a great chance to win again at Roland Garros. We know that Sabalenka is going to be in the thick of it at all the majors. And I expect Coco to be right in there in all the remaining majors too. So I have a feeling those three will keep out. And it isn't to say that Rybakinan and others won't have their say, but I believe that Sabalenka, Coco, and Iga, you know, or I should say Sabalenka, Iga, and Coco, maybe in that order, they will be the hierarchy of the women's game, and they'll come away with the biggest prizes. Because I still think before this year is out, I guess if I had to call it now, I'd say Sabalenka gets another, Coco gets one, and Iga gets one. And that's how the four majors are divided.
Yeah, and for Iga, it's also going to be Roland Garros Clay Olympics. So she's got that as well. And
yeah,
Roland Garros. So there's going to be some pressure on her to win both those tournaments and try to do a little bit better at Wimbledon. And her run to me, you know, obviously one of the memorable standout matches against Danielle Collins in the second round. But to me, it was similar to Wimbledon in the sense she had that standout match where she got out of jail against Bencic. And then, you know, we thought that would carry her maybe to her first Wimbledon title. And then here, I thought she would go much deeper after Rybakina lost Ostapenko. I was surprised to see her go out to Noshkova in the fashion that she did from a setup. But, you know, I'm sure she'll bounce back from it. And it was...
Oh, she will. Yeah. She will. She will. I have no doubt.
Yeah, for sure. And so it was overall a pretty good tournament on the men's and women's side. And I think it sets us up really nicely for the rest of the year and the Sunshine Swing and the clay season after that. And yeah, a lot of great highlights. And like you said, 35 five-set matches on the men's side, you know, tied with 83 U.S. Open. So, yeah, I think we'll be looking back at this one very fondly in the coming years.
And man, there were an awful lot of really high-quality five-set matches among that 35. So that's what made it so compelling and so enjoyable to watch. And yeah, again, the rest of the men's year is going to be fascinating as well because Sinner he's taken a load off his shoulders now because people have been expecting things from him for really, really going back to 2020. Now he's arrived and Carlos is determined to get back and Novak is not going to take that one blow and allow people to write him off because he's still highly motivated. So, then there's Daniel, of course, who's maybe the most fascinating member of that foursome to see what he can do. So I think we're in for a tremendous year among the men as well.
Yeah, totally agree, Steve. And we're in for a tremendous year of more podcasts and recaps. So,
okay, you got it. I'm here.
Yeah, for sure, Steve. To all of our listeners, yeah, be sure to check this out on YouTube as well as on the podcast platforms and Apple and Spotify and wherever else you get your podcasts. And yeah, thank you so much, Steve, for all your time and yeah, pretty thorough recap and conversation.
Thanks, Vance. Enjoy doing it and look forward to post Paris.
Yep, same here as well, Steve. Take care.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.